Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast. I'm so excited to begin this series, capturing the caretaker's point of view, going through a diagnosis of vascular compressions of Nutcracker Syndrome. We have Heather and Danny here. Thank you all so much for doing this, and I hope that this helps not just the caretaker and other in the audience's world, maybe that caretaker's listening, but it also helps the patient, those of us that have been diagnosed with Nutcracker syndrome or any other vascular compression, better empathize with those that are caretakers in our world. Maybe opens up avenues for discussion. It creates more autonomy for a caretaker. So thank you all for sparking this. You all are the first ones that I'm interviewing, and I really hope that this does some good and helps caretakers feel loved in this space. So thank you. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, and thank you for providing the space for us to talk.
Yeah, thank you. And the focus on caretakers, it's a tough one because I really want to make the focus on the person going through it. So yeah, I'm glad to speak of my experience. I was also probably going to keep referring back to what it's like to be with someone and what they're going through too.
Absolutely. And I think that you just made a really great point of like almost kind of this discomfort of being like, well, yeah, I'm talking about me, but I'm used to always kind of going back to her, to them. And it's a, yeah, like let's lean into that discomfort because I actually think that's where the medicine is at. Because it is, it's like when a health crisis happens, that health crisis takes the air out of the room. And it's really hard to say, like, maybe you've had a really bad day, Danny, but you're like, oh, but it's not in comparison to maybe the pain that she's going through or they're going through. And so, how can we like create a more balanced space for that? And just wanting to spark some hopeful curiosity amongst this group, and maybe even outside the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast, there's other people that are chronically ill that their caretakers are trying to navigate. So, I want to start out, Heather, with. If you don't mind just kind of situating us to your Nutcracker syndrome journey, what that's like and some of the emotions that have come up for you in getting diagnosed and where you're at today.
Well, I know this is going to resonate with most people in our boat. But my first symptoms, I believe, started in 2020, which I didn't even get COVID until 2024. So it would just happenstance. But my first symptom was I would start to get this really weird pain in my left side. And it wasn't the flank pain, it wasn't in the back, it was my abdomen. And I went to my doctor and, I did like an ultrasound of my spleen and CT scans, and oh, there's nothing there. And the pain was so bad that I noticed too that it would start almost always when I was sitting, and then it would go away or lessen if I laid on my left side in the fetal position. So the pain was so bad multiple times. I went to the ER, I went to urgent care. They got to find something, right? And multiple CT scans and same thing every time. It felt better when I laid down. It never started when I was laying down. But every time I was told that, get this, I was either constipated or my favorite, I was ovulating. So obviously those weren't the case. I was living this with this for a while, and actually, coming soon at the beginning of 2026, I'll be 3 years of being disabled and not working because I also have lupus and gastroparesis and EDS and POTS and all those, except for the POTS, all those were found within this journey as well within the past 3 years. So 2025 has been the year of answers for me. But going back to Nutcracker, it's just kind of one of the things if I didn't know if it was related to the whole systematic illness that I had. But there was one night where my lupus wasn't feeling well. I was flaring, and Danny was like, you know what? Let's go see a comedy show. And I was like, that sounds great. So we went to this little comedy place, sitting down for not even a half an hour, and I get this 10 out of 10 pain on my right abdomen side. So bad, I couldn't stand, I couldn't speak, I was crying, and that's like for me, I'm so used to pain. That was very weird. And luckily our car was right outside. Danny put me in the car, rushed me to our local ER, and they did blood work and imaging, and the blood work found I had an AKI or acute kidney injury. My blood pressure was also so high that it was basically at the point where I could have a stroke. And they did a CT scan, and I don't know what's wrong. Maybe you're just dehydrated, even though I told them I had drank, a lot of water beforehand because I have POTS. So I was really bothered by this. I was like, what hurt my kidney? Why was my blood pressure so high? What in the world caused that pain? Like, I was afraid for a long time to even sit because that pain was so bad. So Danny, actually, since he's in the tech world, he a while ago made me an AI model that was trained off of all of my health data. And with that model, I was able to talk to it and tell it these different things happened, what could be possibly going on. And through that, and I'm a history major, so I always learn, you can use something like that to start, but don't use it to finish. So I used it to start, and like, I've never heard of Nutcracker, because what it was saying is that there was a stenosis, the narrowing of your kidney caused the high blood pressure, because when the blood's not going to your kidney, it tricks the kidney into creating, I forget what it's called, but this chemical that raises your blood pressure. That also, of course, hurt your kidney because it's not getting the blood supply it needs. And so it just kind of like dawned on me, like, I've never heard of this before, but that sounds interesting and no one else knows. So I was trying to look at imaging ideas online because I had access to my CT scan imaging, and I love imaging. I joined this Facebook support group for both local EDS and then also for Nutcracker. And I met someone on there who had Nutcracker and also all these other compression syndromes that, again, I never heard of. She actually sent me pictures. She's like, try to find the image in your CT scan of this view, of this view. And I couldn't believe it. There in the very CT scan imaging that was there for 5 years because I went back and looked at them all, there was Nutcracker. There was the compression. There was the dilation of the vein before the compression. There was the small angle. Just it was all there the whole time. And it just like, I've had so much gaslighting from doctors that I was like, nah, like that's too easy. That's too easy to have been missed. But I have a wonderful naturopath who knows about things like this. I went to her because she was the one I really felt safe kind of bringing this up to and not hurting her ego because she's really good. And she was like, yep, that looks like Nutcracker. And she sent me to a vascular surgeon. He did a venogram, baba boom, Nutcracker. So that's where we are. I am waiting to see which surgery I'm going to have and where. Because I have lupus, when you have lupus, your kidneys are gold. They're gold in general, but when you have lupus, your kidneys are very sensitive to the disease. And so nephrectomy, being a donor with my kidney is not an option. I have to save my kidneys, and there's really no studies I can find that talk about it. My vascular surgeon didn't know, so I'm still trying to figure out and talk to different vascular surgeons as far as what would the best route be for me, knowing that my connective tissue is messed up on a multiple of areas, but then also needing to preserve my kidneys as much as possible. So that's where I'm at.
I have to say, for the people listening to this, you can't see us, but I'm just shaking my head up and down because when I found out how to look at my CTs and I went back to 5 years worth, I was like, it was there the whole time. I
The whole time.
just, I felt betrayed. I mean, just all the things, because you're just like, again, you were gaslit and you internalize that shame. You start to think, am I a hypochondriac? And then when you see as clear as day, and you're like, how is it that I'm not a radiologist? And I was, I mean, it was just, it's like a something doesn't feel right. I'm on a weird timeline, or I just did a lot of drugs and I'm in some alternate universe, So, something I want to ask really quick before we transition into Danny, your experience with all this, how did it feel for you once you were able to start getting answers?
Yeah, well, so I remember after the venogram, the vascular surgeon did the venogram himself. And he actually, funny enough, he looked at my CT scans and was like, oh, I don't see it. But he did the venogram and said, there it is. You know, there's the different measurements and everything. And so I remember waking up from the anesthesia from the venogram and him telling me, and I cried. And it wasn't a cry of fear, it wasn't a cry of, you know, like, anything negative, it was more so of just like, I freaking told you. And it was like happiness. 'Cause again, you know, this has been the year of answers for me. And all the different things I have are unfortunately very difficult to diagnose. And so many people, especially women and people of color, just have like the hardest time getting answers. And so, to even though this answer, you know, it would have been a lot better if it was just, you know, I had the flu or something. It's like to have an answer, like I will take it. I was very happy.
Absolutely. And I think first of all, congrats on all the answers because it
Thanks.
really is. It's validating. It's still, as much as there's relief, it's very convoluted with a lot of emotion, right? Like there's the relief and the validation that something's going on, and there's the
Sure.
heaviness and the grief of what's to come and needing to
Yes.
swallow that too. And
Yeah.
so that's why I like asking the question, like, how did that feel for you? Because I really want people's emotions listening to this to be validated of like, at the same time, you're just like, okay, yay. And then it hits you and you're just like, oh shit. Like,
Yeah.
this means
Yeah, there
something big's coming down the pipeline.
Yeah, there's definitely that aspect too. But and yeah, I feel like I'm constantly in the grief cycle with my health. But at the same time, I yeah. At that moment, pure
Absolutely,
joy.
absolutely. Yeah, I just found out a couple of days ago that the valves in my legs are shot from all the damage that's been accrued. So I'm likely
Oh,
gonna,
no.
hopefully, the final chapter is the ablating of the small system veins in my legs to get them to my deep system.
Oh.
But it is, it's like this kind of grieving of I feel so much better and I have so much of my life back. But the vascular system touches every part of your body. It's not just like, oh, so it is, it's a full body experience that you're like, maybe your pain is in that left flank mostly, but it's causing damage in other places. And so I'm glad you have answers and you're looking at like next steps. Danny, I was going to say for you, hearing that you created this like AI thing that I'm like, don't I anticipate getting comments on this episode saying, can you do one for us? Like, can I give him my, you know, like, I could see that almost turning into a thing for you where you're like kind of helping people because it is so helpless when you're in a space.
Yeah.
I live in Denver, you're in Portland, so we're in like bigger areas that has more access to people, but so many people I get will be like, we're in rural such and such, and
Yeah.
we have no idea, and we have to travel for everything and the finances of that, and so there's different levels of helplessness, if you will, based on region and where you're at and resources and stuff. But I did, Danny, I would love to, everything that Heather went through, all the kind of snapshot of the story, tell us what it was like for you standing hand in hand with her at that comedy show, going in that pain and taking her to the ER. What has this journey been like for you?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I mean, it's a mix of things, of course. It's a mix of like really scary, like when she's having that pain and we're out at the show and you don't know if this is something that is the hospital right now versus these things happen and you just got to get through it. So, you know, I'm just trying to be there for her. So a lot of it is, you know, I feel like my emotions, even we've been married and it's my emotions are tied with her. So when she's, you know, feeling good and relief, I feel that relief. And when she's in pain, I feel in pain. So it's a little bit of also, I'm just so much less knowledgeable. She's gotten to be so knowledgeable about, you know, like you said, doing all the jobs of everybody that's supposed to be doing the jobs for her. So I'm just kind of unaware and I try to keep up. And I think that is important for, you know, caregivers listening too, to try to keep up, try to understand what they're going through or the conditions or their, you know, when they come back from the doctor, what the next steps they're planning to do. But also I'll just never be able to keep up. And so more just being there for her. And through all the other diagnoses and journeys that she's had too, it's a lot of, you know, mix of uncertainty and there still is uncertainty. With these moments of it feels like we have a milestone, we learned something, and that kind of those answers, and that relief does come, and that really, yeah, is refreshing. And then you're on to the next either diagnosis or answers to get, or sometimes the next comedy show, even knowing it might be painful, but we're gonna go anyway.
Yeah. I love that y'all go to comedy shows. That's a big thing for Kyle and I, of just like a nice little escape. Laughter is very healing in a lot of ways.
Yes.
What was it like for you, Danny, the moment that Heather got the diagnosis of Nutcracker?
Yeah, it was again a little bit of relief and uncertainty mixed together, because relief, I was thinking this is good, right? Like I think I understand and this is helpful. Then knowing that a test result says something, it's a really mixed feeling, because who knows whether you can believe that result, because she's gotten so many mixed up results in the past. So you just don't know whether you can actually feel confident in what it was. It just felt like this was real. There was something here, and that there was a test that was going to help not only her next steps, but also just feeling validated. So that's helpful for me too. Whenever kind of feels like we're moving forward in this, and yet still I didn't know what the surgery was going to be like. I didn't know. And we still have questions around that, but at least the moments of relief is nice to celebrate.
Absolutely. And Heather, when you were diagnosed, did they in that moment kind of say, and these are the treatments that would go along with this, or was that later to come?
That was later at a separate appointment with the vascular surgeon. It was kind of funny though, because he's going through the different surgery options, and I was like, yep, I learned this like 3 months ago. Yep, keep talking.
I feel like I've already been on the
Yeah,
internet,
let me
but
tell
you
you
don't
what
want
an
to say
AT is.
that. Like, you don't want to say that though, because it'll be like, oh my gosh, you like your research, like I get it. Well, and I think that that's interesting. So there's almost two, there's like, you get the, mine happened simultaneously. Like whenever I actually had a lady, I went in and she was like telling me about May Thurner, which is what the only thing I thought I had. And then she started talking about this thing called Nutcracker. And she's like, yeah, and the people that have this have to like go either donate their kidney or relocate it, or at least that's what we recommend to do, and not do the transposition or the stent. And I was like, why is she talking to me about this? And then she was like, now let me pull up your results of what, the doctor said. And it was like inconclusive for May Thurner, and you have a very severe case of Nutcracker. So I was like holding like, damn, that sucks for these Nutcracker people that they have to go do this. Also, why are you wasting my time talking to me about this? So I was like being
Oh
told you
no.
have Nutcracker and you're gonna have to have a transplant almost at the same time. So it wasn't just like getting the diagnosis and then maybe later figuring out the treatment, but it sounds like you already knew what the treatment options were prior to even formally getting the diagnosis, correct? Okay, so. So you had almost like wrapped your head around it emotionally a little bit more versus it getting slapped in your face.
My biggest concern is that my venogram results wouldn't show Nutcracker, because my pain is so positionally dependent on me being upright. And so I know sometimes when people have venograms, they're on like a tilt table to see that difference. But luckily, mine showed up with me just being flat. And I actually, talking about May Thurner, I may also have, well, I have SMAS, but like, I haven't been diagnosed. And then, oh my gosh, what's the other one?
Malls,
Malls.
median,
So those, the joy that I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast know is that you can't just go to one doctor to get all these diagnosed. So I'm on that journey as well. But luckily, because of the community that I found online and people that have already gone through this, I know what doctors. I'm going to Seattle, which is a few hours away from where I live, but I already have referrals placed to those doctors to see if I have those as well.
Good. Just so you know, to give you some hope, my CT did show like Nutcracker SMAS, like, right. I mean, if you have Nutcracker severe, you're likely going to have the superior metastatic artery syndrome. With that said, when I moved my kidney, my angle is so much wider now at that junction that I don't, it was almost the opposite of what you think. Some people think if you take the left renal vein out, it collapses the aorta and SMA. But mine actually, like, the angle is so beautiful. And I have like side by side comparisons. So, but it's hard to know. Like, there's no really like, should I do SMAS first? Should I do? But with that being said, Danny, to bring it back to you, not only your reaction to the diagnosis, but did you already have an understanding of what the treatment options were going to be once she was formally diagnosed?
A bit. And this is where I have to be honest, is that I get lost in all of these things. So, I think so. And then I'm trying to remember which one is Nutcracker versus lupus versus this other thing that we don't even know. So that's taken away a lot of it. It's like, I do feel bad not knowing how to place all these, but I think that's important for people to understand is that it's hard n not only to be a caretaker, but of course to go through it not knowing. But for me, I still feel like, okay, is this the thing we were talking about last week on that day or the other one that I'm not quite sure about? So, yeah.
Well, that's interesting you say. Even some of the stuff we were probably just sitting here, you're like, oh wait, hold on, malls, that's what, where is
And
this coming
I
from?
think I'm getting it better as we go. And that's part of it is like knowing even just which category of things, and I'm getting better.
Oh, that's so interesting. And so something I'm gathering from this, and again, I'm a professor, so I'm always thinking about like solution focused education based. Well, let me start with this question. In what ways? So you still trying to wrap your head around all these different aspects of like, wait, are you talking about Nutcracker? Is this a lupus thing? Like,
Yeah.
is how does that influence how you then emotionally experience your role as a caretaker?
I think and we've gone through some very good learning times for me to know when I know what I'm talking about when I don't, for example. And like I used to, and I think generally in life, I'm really about like ideas and problem solving and giving advice and suggestions. But I just need to be really careful about that for many reasons. But one of them is knowing less about which is which. So it's gone from me giving maybe ideas, okay, this is what you got to look into, or this is another idea, to really deferring to her. And she's kind of got a better sense of these. So more it's me just trying to ask some follow-up questions to make sure I understand. And I do, feel like there's certain categories of things. There's like the immediate pains versus the fatigue and energy, and nausea. So with this being the really sharp 10 out of 10 pain, this is in a different category too. So I did have a sense better of, there might be Nutcracker and with that, what that means with veins and that it's, positionally dependent. So, sometimes there are some things that help latch on to what's going on, and it's sad when it has to be pain that bad, but it helps to like even sense of direction of which ones these are.
Absolutely. When I was in my master's degree, and I brought it into my PhD with me. There's a theory called uncertainty reduction theory. It's a 1997, sorry, theory. And then in 2001, they upgraded it to like uncertainty management theory. But the whole concept is uncertainty is very uncomfortable. I feel like everybody could shake their head at that and say, yes, that's uncomfortable. And in 1997, it was a concept of we want to reduce it. And then in 2001, they came in and said, no, it's about managing the uncertainty. And there's these seven tenets on how you can reduce or manage. And the number one thing to help manage uncertainty is to gather data. And I think that's what us as Nutcracker patients do is we're so like we're living in this body that's like, am I going to die? Like, am I going to throw a blood clot at any point? Whatever it is. So you're just gathering data. And I think, but it's also overwhelming too, because there's so much research out there that's not out there that doesn't answer questions for us. But it's the same thing for the caretaker, because I would almost say because you all are like a degree of separation, that the uncertainty is even more convoluted. Because you might have not gone to the doctor's appointment and gotten the first hand. You might not have been in that session to be able to ask your specific questions, for example. Like Kyle is a business owner, so it's like he could come when he could. But then I just started having so many doctor's appointments. He was like, I would have to literally quit my job to come with you. And so he felt so disconnected from it, and he would get like second person point of view, like of me just coming home and telling him what. And so he never had the privilege of having his questions answered. And so have you, maybe just anything I just said, Danny, does any of that resonate with you? How would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely resonates a lot of it. Both that I'm also working and busy and I can't make it to appointments, let alone, like you say, it's a full-time job going to all the appointments. So it's this interesting mix of that uncertainty that you described and that I wasn't there in the room. I don't have the information. I didn't do all the research. So I do feel like I need to ask those questions or I want to understand. And at the same time, these ideas that I have that might help, that are also maybe missing out on what she's learned. So this has been a tough part where I might have this idea. It's like, oh, why don't you try this? But it's because I wasn't in the room to hear why not to try that. And so I think a lot of times it's even waiting on some of those ideas to really soak in like that uncertainty or ask the questions to get to the point of then having an idea to offer. But I do feel like the not knowing is a good thing to come to acceptance. I think that's something I don't know, a mantra or some version I'm still working on, of course, but I think it's not like the uncertainty goes away. It's how to be okay with it and yet still, it's important to get data and find some answers and not just be okay with uncertainty. So it's in a way like a pendulum that keeps swinging back and forth.
Absolutely. And this is summed up the reason why I created this podcast is to have a space where data can be gathered of lived experiences so people could come here and be like, oh, help, you know, how I don't know how to go and get this or create the community, but there's this podcast that they can go listen to lived experiences.
Awesome.
There's also, when I was in my master's degree, we had to write a, I took a class, a meditation class. And first 8 weeks was doing meditation. The last 8 weeks was doing meditation plus looking at the literature on it. And I actually took uncertainty reduction slash management theory. And this was in like 2015, I think. And I recommended that it need to be changed to uncertainty acceptance theory. Like us, instead of trying to get rid of uncertainty, it's more changing our relationship with the uncertainty and accepting it for what it is. And not because uncertainty can cause a lot of stress and anxiety. So I loved you said that, Danny, on like the accepting, like at some point you just got to accept where you're at. I am curious. So you talked about a smidge on how you tried to support Heather through this. And I'm curious your perspective, Danny, on Heather supporting you through this process as well.
It's amazing what she has to do on top of everything for herself. So, I think part of it is again what she's going through with her health on top of what she already does in our relationship, just for our lives, like still, taking care of so much around our pets and the house and the yard and projects and family and friends. So, it's all of those things she's still continuing to support our lives and in amazing ways. So that's to me very helpful. Again, I'm pretty busy with my work and some side projects and other things. So to feel like I can be able to do my thing and hopefully provide for some stability too, to then have her already be able to take care of so many of these other things has been super helpful. Not to mention being emotionally supportive of me. Like as she's, going through all of this herself, she's working with me so well and asking just about me and my independence. That's been a struggle for me of my independence and, what are we able to do? What am I able to do? And a lot of times she's, limited to being in bed for most of the day. So supporting me sometimes can be just even a small thing, but that small thing is all the effort that she has that day on top of everything else.
Absolutely. Yeah, and there was Brené Brown talked about on a podcast or somewhere about checking in with her partner and saying, "Hey, how much in your, like what is your percentage today?" They would and she would be like, "I only got 20%." And he's like, "Okay, I got 60. I'll go take care of the kids or something." Like they would really negotiate every day on like where are you at? Where are you at? And sometimes the reality could be that you're both at 10%, but it's a it's more of just being like, "Okay, if we're both at 10%, then could this task wait till tomorrow? Could like how can we be kind to both of ourselves here?" And I think the caretaker role, like Kyle and I's story is very interesting because we started dating and then 3 months later I got the diagnosis. So it what we didn't have, I mean, for this man to still be sticking around and I'm hoping that he's been really busy, but I would love to capture our story here. But there's a lot of nuance there, and at the same time, it's a when illness and health issues come in, it's a lot of having to renegotiate what the unwritten social contract was prior, and like, is this something that has to get done today? Could it just be pushed to tomorrow? And that's where kind of the grief you get thrown out of this routine as well of you know, maybe you get married and you were both kind of engaging in the relationship in a certain way that was unwritten, and then sickness comes in, and now roles have to shift a bit. You have to bring in more compassion into the space than you were used to. And so I love asking Kyle now, I'm like, how did you grow like through this process, you know? And because you don't realize it's happening in the moment. So I think that's lovely, Heather, too. I love the and something I want to normalize for the if you're a nutcracker diagnosed individual that was listening to this podcast is asking your partner, your number one caretaker, like, how can I support you through this, right? Like mine was it was us setting that boundary of like Kyle doesn't want to talk about medical stuff all the time, you know? So like, and I didn't blame him. So it was like, okay, I started asking, hey, do you have space right now for me to chat about my anxiety? And sometimes he would say no. And I'd be like, you know, you want to almost be like, but at the same time, it's like trying to give the caretaker autonomy to be able to say yes and no is really powerful because there's such a lack of control of what you can and can't control because you're at the mercy of the medical system. That if we can create that sense of autonomy, ever how small, then it can help you both navigate as well as you can.
Yeah, we actually started implementing that within the year or so, because I'm stuck in bed a lot of the time because of all my issues. But so my day consists of what did I learn medically, or guess what the cats did, or our dog. And
Yes.
so that's a lot for a person to come upstairs and be bombarded with all the cat information or medical information. So the asking definitely beforehand do that a lot too. And when we reconnected, we actually met when we were little kids at band camp, because we both play percussion. But when we reconnected as adults, about 9 years ago, I had actually just gotten POTS, seemingly out of nowhere, and I think it's related to my nutcracker, but who knows. But so he did know me when I had POTS, and my POTS was pretty bad back then. But then it got better because I found what worked for my POTS. And right before I got sick with what we now know as lupus, and I had to stop working, I was working from a to change my career from a desk job to become a police officer. So I was doing like really intense, like physical things and excelling at that. And we both became certified resource parents, which is foster parents, and took in our first foster child, who was 13 years old at the time. So we were crushing it in a lot of ways. And then my body's like, nope. And that's when everything went downhill. So he partly knew what he was signing up for, but definitely not as bad as it is
Exactly.
now.
No, exactly. It's a downward. And Danny, I'm curious, what was when you started implementing the like Heather being like, hey, are you willing to talk about this? How was that for you to be given the choice of, yeah, I can't do that right now?
Yeah, that's huge. It's in a way, hopefully a small thing, but a very big thing. And yeah, I think it still doesn't feel great to say no, I can't talk about this right now. But she's offering the space, and there are times I take her up on it. And I just think with really anybody, it's just giving those pauses and moments to think about how the other person is feeling. And so that goes both ways, and to make sure that there's time for that, especially in the heat of a lot of things. Like one thing is she wakes up early. Sadly, a lot of because of her condition, her body wakes her up 4 a.m. or something. So she'll be up for 3, 4 hours. I think I get up early for work, but even still, she's been already up. So she's already got a couple hours worth of stories to tell and things happening. So sometimes just a little bit of space, maybe have the sip of coffee first. But yeah, it's also that she's going through so much. So, it's really hard to feel like you're invalidating what they've just been going through. So to find these ways where it's also okay for even her to say back, like, I need to talk about this now. I think
Yeah.
that's a key one. So I do feel like there's a trickier part maybe, which is related to this, which is when she's not feeling well, but she's still going about her day doing things. You can tell that she's just like not feeling well, and I want to still be optimistic. I want to be happy. I want to, or she's in real bad pain. So this is just a real tricky one. I've tried to figure out like how can I still and we still feel happy and positive when there are moments throughout the day that she's going to feel such pain and really horrible things. So I think that's another one where she's not feeling well for me to then say, nope, don't want to talk about it now. That doesn't quite feel appropriate either.
Yeah, that's so. It is an interesting balance. I mean, I feel like if Kyle was here, I almost am like thinking, man, it'd be cool if Kyle and I were one like couples interviewing a couple because I feel like he would just be like, yes, brother. Like, I completely get it. Because there were times that like I would be really struggling. And I had also, like, our story is that I was living in a van full time for 2 years. My first symptom hit. I met Kyle and was like, yo, I'm about to have this hysterectomy. We had 3 good months and then I got hit with Nutcracker. So he really was like, I even literally said, you did not sign up for this. You do not have to. You can literally exit stage left. I will not judge you at all. I mean, to that point of like, I'll figure something else out. But it is hard because there were times I would say, like, hey, I really want to talk to you about this, or this is what I'm thinking. And he'd just be like, I do not have the capacity. And it's hard not to take that personally. But I do think, as us that have been diagnosed with Nutcracker, it's one of the most loving things that we can do for a caretaker is provide that space for them to say yes or no. And then maybe it's even coming in and saying, is there, okay, and the caretaker saying, right now is not a great time, but can you give me a couple hours and then I'll circle back, right? Like, because then it's communicating, I do care that you feel this way. I don't have the capacity, but I do want at some point. So it's really creating, and that is something I do think illness, like silver lining, it creates like better communication if you allow it to come in and be like, okay, how are we going to navigate this really hard space for you to have that. I'm even starting to think I want to like start a WhatsApp and maybe see if we can get some Nutcracker people in it and just
Oh,
have our own little
nice.
support group. Because I had somebody that came forward that I was like texting with every day. It was like, how are you feeling today? And that took pressure off of Kyle, you know, and like that was awesome. So it's making me think, like, what can we actively do as Nutcracker people to create the support system we need that takes the pressure off of the caretaker to not only have to be the logistical support, the emotional support, the financial support, like all of the things. And we can say, hey, let's take this off of your plate. We'll obviously talk to you about it, sure. But I'm not looking to, you know, with Kyle, it was like I moved out here, I had no friends. My family didn't want to be involved. So I really resonate with what I think a lot of people in this space are feeling that. What, Danny, as far as from your perspective, like what changed in your life with, like, again, you said y'all met, you kind of knew a little bit the pots was there, but then things rubbed up, body like broke down, said, nope, we're not doing this. What was that? How did you experience that, Danny, from a caretaker's point of view? Like, how did your life change with this change?
And there's like the Nutcracker specifics and also then the broader medical journey. So with the Nutcracker specifically, it was more of like, okay, there's something really, really painful that has some answer here. So that changes in there's answers in some form. And there's still, of course, the next steps of surgery and difficulties. But that was, I think, how the life changed in a way is more of like we're on a path towards answers. In the broader kind of medical journey, it changed our life in a lot of ways. It was, just different kinds of things that we can plan or not plan for. We like to travel or we like to visit with friends and family, and it's just we need to change plans or maybe not maybe have a backup plan or plan B if she's not feeling well and needs to leave, or staying up late at night is hard, and so just changing our schedules. For me, it's like I just love her and I want to be with her, and this is what it is. So, like, I don't know. I think the signing up for is an interesting one because I signed up for being with her, and so, whatever that means. And to me, you mentioned some silver lining. There's more than just silver lining. There's like ways that I feel like I can now be with a person that I never could before, or talk with a person that way. So, like, through all of the hard stuff, there's also the connection and love that it brings. So, that changed our lives, just to be
Yeah,
together.
that's so cute. I feel like I'm like this is like that Hallmark Christmas Hallmark movie where you're like, I just signed up to be with her, and I'm like, ah, that's so wonderful. I love that so much. Like you're
Love
just
made in
watching
band
it, and you're
camp.
like, yes, I love this so much. You mentioned backup plans, and I think that that's actually something I'm thinking here now that, not that. I just didn't think about, and I think could be something that couples moving forward can speak amongst themselves on, like, that could be supportive to both you as the caretaker to not have to, like, in the moment come up with, like, oh, what are we supposed to do here? Because that could be really, like, fight, like the fight or flight or freeze response. Sometimes you can freeze. So having that, did y'all talk a lot about those backup plans prior of, like, hey, we're going to go to this comedy show as an example? What is Plan B, C? Could y'all talk towards that a little bit more?
Yeah, so we have a couple of hand signals. So if I, you know, make the what millennials will know as the telephone hand signal, I have to describe it because I don't know if Gen Z has held a phone this way, but if like make a Y and put up to your face, that is call 911. So when I do that, because there's a lot of times I can't speak when the pain and I don't do you I don't know if you do you know what a laryngeal spasm is, and I'm probably saying that wrong.
Is that your tell me about it.
So I got this and found out what it was later, and it is terrifying, and I'm so sorry if anybody else has had this. I'm sorry, but vomiting because
Oh my God.
medication I took made me ill. And when I came up for air, I couldn't breathe. Like there is like the smallest amount of air able to come in and out of my mouth. And I have a lot of mental health skills because of my past, which has been very helpful. So at first thought is I aspirated on the vomit. And so like, oh my gosh. But you know, like all this time I can't breathe, and I couldn't breathe literally for at least a minute, like a full minute, if you can think about that, while being terrified of what is happening. So I just, you know, like I'm knocking on the floor, getting Danny's attention because he is in the other room. I was about to make the hand sign, but I just sat back and I noticed that if I like pursed my lips and breathed very minimally, I could get more air, and then all of a sudden it started to be more and more air. So basically what I had after talking, I went to the ER in case I did aspirate pneumonia or aspirate vomit, and I luckily didn't, but it's a laryngeal spasm that I may be more prone to because of EDS and lupus and stuff like that, but it's basically your larynx is spasming, and it usually lasts for about 1 to 2 minutes, but the way to stop it is to breathe through pursed lips. And so now we know, like, if I point with one finger to my throat, that means laryngeal spasm, because now I'm terrified to vomit instead of, you know, like a choking signal. But so talking about second or backup plans, I love Disney, and we went to Disneyland for the second time this year. A couple months ago, I was thinking I'd have my nutcracker surgery, you know, by now, which I haven't. But so we called it the Tame the Veins trip, because before I got my neck surgery, it was Wreck My Neck trip. During this trip, you know, I did like a lot of preparation, you know, drinking water, you know, making sure, like that I had enough snacks and certain kinds of snacks and my fan, like all these things to make sure I could have a good day at Disney. The second day, something just really terrible happened. Like I could barely stand up. It was hot, but Danny had to like walk me over, and it was to the point where my brain was saying, "Screw it. We are going on Tower of Terror. I don't care. I can do this." But Danny was obviously like, "You are a limp noodle. Like something is wrong." And so we had to leave the park early. It was like really terrible. I was down for the rest of the day, and then the trip home was rough. So I still don't know what happened. I think it was lupus related, but who the hell cares? Or who knows? Sorry. You should care. But what we learned from this experience is if Heather cannot talk, if Heather cannot stand, don't listen to Heather. Just so we wrote a document of like if there are these, call emergency services. So there's been kind of a lot of these different plans that we've put into place, but the hand signals is really important.
Ooh, the hand signals is very interesting. Tell me one tell me again in that document you wrote, what were some of the things that you wrote in there?
It was if I can't speak,
Okay, if you can't
because like if
speak.
the pain is so bad that I can't speak. If I am, especially if like I'm crying, because that's, you know, like there's nothing wrong with crying, of course, but like for me, for pain to bring tears, that's some pretty serious pain.
Same.
Yeah, I think one of them was just like, if you feel like you need to override Heather, like do it, because he's been really grateful, or really gracious. Sorry, my brain fog is setting in, but he's been really gracious about, like trusting me. And, if I say no, I got this. Like, I can do this, I promise. But we also both know that I am stubborn and I don't want to give in to my health issues. And so, like, I don't even know how he does this, but he is getting in a really good mix of knowing when to listen and when to override. I don't know if you want to talk on that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree in that it's taken some time to learn about both of those, and it's not easy to be the one to tell her you're not doing something right in a moment like that. And that doesn't always go well. It's just I think this is where the longer term communication comes in, where it's like we're going to talk it through, we're going to figure it out, and then afterwards, what did we learn from that, or how can we, make the new document or update the plan?
Ooh, this is so powerful, first of all. And the reason why is because it brings into this conversation consent, where because you, when you're diagnosed with something and your body is going haywire and breaking down, some of the helplessness of a caretaker, like I had an ovarian cyst rupture, and it was the first time Kyle
Ooh.
ever experienced how I've had mole. We're on like 20 plus something ovarian cyst
Oh
ruptures. And I
no.
know when they happen, I'm like, I'm not going to the ER. I know what they're going to do. I'm not going to waste my time. And I just have to let I have to sit with the pain. I have to let my body go through it. The first time Kyle watched it happen, he was like, what the? And so if, and so it was after I had to kind of talk to him about it, but he was so, the caretaker has all their emotions come in during those moments. Like Heather, when you're at Disney and you're having so much fun, and then all of a sudden you can't walk and stuff. And if you haven't had these proactive conversations on, the caretaker could come in and be like, well, I don't want to override. Like she's telling me she's got it. But then you intuitively know what the caretaker, I don't know, honey. I want to respect you and your autonomy, but right now this isn't looking good. This is such a beautiful example of like the hand signals, I think is a really great practical strategy to empower our audience to think about and speak about with your caretakers, whether it's your primary caretaker, like your partner, or just like if you're going on a family vacation, let everybody know. But that document you're talking about of like, hey, I'm like either literally or metaphorically going to sign off on letting you know that I consent to you overriding me. Because you are in a better headspace than I am. Because Heather, I'm resonating with you a lot. I'm a hyper independent woman. I can get up, I can stand up, leave me alone. There comes a moment, though, that you need somebody to step in. That's been some healing moments for me with Kyle when he can just be like, nope, I'm going to do this for you right now. And then, so I think that's, thank you all for sharing that. That is a majorly proactive thing that looking back, I wish I'm not going to say I don't want to shame myself for not doing it, but moving forward with Kyle, I want to do that and say, hey, like, let's actually have these conversations on. And then the opposite for the caretaker. What if something happens to you, Danny? When would be a moment that Heather could maybe, if you were being really stubborn about something, when could she override for you in random situations? So yeah, thank you all for sharing that. I think that's lovely. I did want to ask about for you, Danny, what was the hardest part for you adjusting to Heather's the reality of what she is going through?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is just again, like being there with somebody who's going through something like that is just how to be with them, how to be okay. If they're really not feeling well, what do you do? Do you sit by their side? Do you go off and do your own thing? And don't feel great going off and doing my own thing, but sometimes that's also important. So I think adjusting to knowing how life really will change, and that's okay, and that's part of our life together. And then within that, what can you change? What is under your control? And sometimes it's pretty small things. And I do feel like with the amount that we can plan something, and this is kind of related to the last conversation, just generally plans, like you can't really plan the same way. You may always just need to plan to leave the party or not be able to go in case something comes up. So I think that's a really hard one when, there's a lot of things that I think, both of us would want to do, and we just either have to say no to or have a plan B for. Also of course, the just day to day with all of the doctor's appointments, pain, difficulties, like it just changes the schedule of the day. It changes how, I need to be there to maybe take over some things while she's gone. But it also, I think the question was about the hardest part, right? It also keeps coming back to the benefits that come from those too. So I could talk about that too. But I guess, yeah, those are pretty hard parts.
Well, and I want to, Danny, just in this time that we've been chatting, you seem to have a very calm demeanor about you. My assumption is that that's kind of how you show up in the world predominantly. Is that correct? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And so I think some of, so in the psychology of injury class I teach, there's like these models to conceptualize a client's case when they're going through injury or illness. And one of them is like when you're working with a client who's been diagnosed or has an injury, you want to first look at what is their personality, their coping resources, and their history of stressors. So, like Heather, that would mean we'd be like, okay, do you have a high state or trait anxiety? Do you have maladaptive perfectionism? Do you have ADD, ADHD? Like different things like that. Your history of stressors. Have you had another major diagnosis before? What's your medical history like? Is your, even outside the medical space, is your family going, like, are you going through a breakup? Are your parents getting divorced? Are you transitioning into a new job at the time of the diagnosis? Things like that. Coping resources are like, are you seeing a therapist? Do you have your own meditation routine? Things like that. But what the literature doesn't, and this was something that came up for me as a massive gap, was your person, Heather, for you, your the interaction of your personality, your history of stressors, and your coping resources are going to interact with that of your caretaker's personality, history of stressors, and coping resources. And so for you, your personality, Danny, at least just in this space and what you just said, is like you have a pretty calm demeanor about you. And so the I have seen like some of my who I thought was my social support, they weren't actually once because how they interacted with my diagnosis. So like for you, I think with some caretakers it's hard because it's like, well, I'm not allowed to be angry, for example. I'm not allowed to be. Have you ever had those moments of like feeling like you had to subdue yourself emotionally because you didn't necessarily want to make Heather's emotions worse or anything like that, like trying to balance your own emotional landscape, or are you a pretty even keel person this entire time?
Well, I mean, it's in between because like I do feel like I don't know, lucky enough to not feel the anger part. That just doesn't come up for me. It every once in a while, it's not like I never get angry, but for me, it's a little bit more of like I feel like I'm not being heard, or I have something that might help, or I'm trying to help and it's not maybe landing well. So those get frustrating for me. But I just lucky I feel like I can hopefully not get angry about it. But that doesn't mean that I'm great in those moments. I think it can be just as bad to be a calm person who's not helpful as a upset person who's not helpful.
And like on the flip side of that, then, are there ways that you feel like Heather could better support you, like that emotional landscape of, or I'm even thinking of like practical ways of, similar to how it's like, hey, do you have the capacity to talk right now? It's a like, oh, and also like, how are you feeling about this? Like, so that you feel more heard. Are there things for you that could you all could do to navigate that space for you as the caretaker better?
Yeah, well, and what she's been doing, especially as far as the how are you feeling? Like, I don't want to oversimplify, but that does a lot. It's just like, pausing maybe, every once in a while and saying, how are you feeling? And like waiting for the answer, taking it in. I think that does wonders. And I might say that taking it in part is kind of a hard part. Not only do you have to pause and ask how the other person's doing, but you have to listen to them and maybe change what you're doing based on what they said. It's not just a pause. So I think that there's a few steps involved, and especially maybe she's not feeling well. It's okay if she doesn't get all the way to, where maybe I'm hoping in the moment, but I think that pause, asking how you're feeling, asking how I'm feeling, there may only be so many things that could actually happen, but even just hearing me out a little bit helps a lot.
Well, and it's even making me think too, like similar to what I just said, Heather, about creating like a WhatsApp with some other people that's diagnosed that can say where you have your that social support group there. It's like having the exact same thing for caretakers to be able to be a part of just like, Hey, I just got, she just came home. They just came home with this really bad news. Does anybody have space to chat right now? Like, so that you all have a social support space too. 'Cause I've also seen that, like, Kyle's like, I have nobody to talk to. Like, this is such a medically gray area that not even doctors know. So, like, it's not like I can call my mom, like, and really. So, I'm wondering, that's something I'm kind of getting creative here. I'm thinking about moving forward to create that supportive space for you all. There was another, go ahead, Heather, do you have something that's coming up for you with all of this?
Oh, well, I was just thinking, the friend I made, that is luckily local. I haven't met her in person yet because, she, oh my gosh, the poor thing. She has just a lot more going on top of my medical diagnoses. But to have her to talk to, where she like truly understands, it's been fantastic. And I have a amazing therapist who is really skilled in helping people with difficult medical journeys, with the coping and the gaslighting and grieving. So I'm trying to have people outside of Danny to relieve him of that duty because I don't want him to get drained.
Yeah. Do you have that for yourself, Danny? Do you have a support system that's helping you through this?
I've tried a few different kinds. I mean, I have friends that will still play music and have our jam sessions and things. Done a few support groups, whether it was a lupus support group or other caretaker specific support groups. And just versions of my own interests, my own hobbies and focus. But I think it's not solved yet. I think this is something that's ongoing and that I still want to be reaching out or finding people to connect to. And it's interesting to think about when do you do these things together, because then it's more time together and time to be able to build on that versus it is important to have separate time and connection. So still working on that too.
Absolutely, absolutely. So kind of coming down, and we've gotten to it where we're talking about you all as a couple of, I feel like we've answered some of these questions here. Let's see. So on, I shouldn't say on the other side of things because you're still very much in the middle of it, as I feel like anytime you're in the vascular compression space or just autoimmune dysautonomia space, you're in it, you're locked in. What are things that you unexpectedly gained or learned about yourselves or each other through this process?
Well, I would just echo that she's gained about 10 degrees or something, like professional degrees or job titles or whatever. So that's just another one. Learned and gained is a lot of jobs she shouldn't be having to
Absolutely. Absolutely,
do.
absolutely. Yeah, I'm almost like I need a medical degree, or especially like to be a radiologist, I feel like. Yeah, I'm like I feel like my own little radiologist. I think that's a beautiful thing about the medical space is it strips you down to bare bones, but like almost sometimes feeling that way, but metaphorically and forces you to really see what matters. And circling back around to what you said, Danny, you're like, I just want to be with her. And if this is what it looks like to be with her, then, and I think that's a, such a powerful statement is there's a lot of research, especially women who get diagnosed with breast cancer. I think there's an upwards of 40% of caretakers that find out their partner was diagnosed with something like that will leave.
Oh my
And that's
God.
a, yeah, and it's hard, but at the same time, if you really extrapolate that, Kyle and I had some very deep philosophical conversations about, like he said, he's like, I mean, I do love you. And it's been 2 years now we've been together. So obviously it was like 3 months in, and then I was like, hey, I have to get a kidney auto transplant. And it was like, and we met online, so he definitely stuck around for it and was my primary care person through the entire thing. But he has let me know from the very beginning. He's like, I am not a caretaker. Like I don't, and I, there's a part instead, like we socially construct this narrative of what a caretaker is supposed to look like. Like they have to be supportive at all costs. Like they lose. And that's something with this, these episodes that I really want to capture is like, there is no right or wrong way. I mean, as long as you're not being disrespectful and trying to cause harm to the caretaker or vice versa, but like with Kyle, like he's been very upfront with me from the beginning and been like, yeah, if this was now, we've been together for 2 years. So like the love is there a lot stronger than 3 months in. But it's knowing like, okay, I'm committed to this person that has already expressed this to me and honoring that in him and not demonizing it like some people might. Like he's just being honest. He's not being malicious. Kyle and I have learned so much about each other, just like it sounds like you all have, that maybe without this experience, you wouldn't have gotten to this depth as quickly as you would have, or learned about each other as much.
And there was so something that I think would be helpful for me to mention too, just because I've had it help other people. I actually have a very, I won't go into a trigger topics or anything, but I have a very in-depth mental health history. I had complex PTSD since I was like 3 years old. And before reuniting with him and starting dating him, I'd done a lot of work. I did EMDR. I did a which is helps reprogram your brain to get rid of PTSD or at least store the memory differently. And then after that, I did a year of dialectical behavioral therapy or DBT. And those are amazing classes that teach you kind of how the brain works, how it tries to trick you into staying in emotions that aren't effective, and different skills you can use. So by the time Danny and I reconnected and started dating, I had done so much work on building these skills, but I still had lingering depression and anxiety, and I'm of course medication resistant, right? So there's a therapy that I did that's only legal in Portland that I know about. So I don't know if I can mention it on the podcast, but
What is it?
psilocybin.
Okay, I'm starting ketamine therapy in mid-January here in Denver.
Awesome.
I'm
Awesome.
so excited. Yes.
Okay. Wonderful. So yeah, two sessions of psilocybin, and I had this. I went to a psychologist before we started fostering because I wanted to make sure I was clear and, wouldn't make a child's trauma worse, basically with my own. And so I was basically cleared after two sessions of psilocybin. And so he it was if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have ever tried that method. So I owe my a lot of what I did to strengthen my mental health and strengthen my soul came from me. And at the same time, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have done that therapy that ended up freeing me. And those, those therapies won't work for everybody, but they worked tremendously for me. And so, even before this physical health issue of the past 3 years, including Nutcracker, Danny has showed love and commitment and caretaking, I guess, to in utmost amount. So I'm so grateful for. So I'd be lost without
Yeah,
him.
I love that. Well, I'm actually going to share my ketamine experience on the podcast as I go
Oh,
through it. It's like
wonderful.
it's 6 sessions in 4 weeks and then management
Wow.
after that. Because I'm sitting here, I'm like, you and I are the same person. I was diagnosed with PTSD. I have depression and anxiety. I'm on PTSD nightmare meds now because the medical journey, like my 7 surgeries in 2 years has like the PTSD is coming back in a way, so we're having to like navigate that at the same time. So I'm excited about ketamine therapy. I've been doing a lot of prep work for it to just like receive what I need to receive through that. But I would love
Nice.
to have you on even to like talk about, we kind of chatted about maybe doing an episode on lupus and then maybe doing some on like the mushroom side of things because I'm massive fan of multiple modalities. I've done EMDR for years. I do
Nice.
IFS now, internal family systems, which has been really
Oh,
good.
yeah.
And I love that. And I think even us leaning in as a Nutcracker patient who's either done the auto transplant or on the journey, that's a way of loving the caretaker too, is to say, hey, my brain has been affected by this. Like I told Kyle, I was like, I mean, our relationship is great now, but I'm like, I need to go and process all of this in multiple different ways, just so that I'm not potentially making him hold something that doesn't need to be held. And that's a way that we can support our caretakers too, is
Sure.
holding space for our bodies, obviously, through surgery, but then remembering that our brain is a part of that process too.
Yeah, and I would
So, yeah.
just add one aspect is that I've learned through all of this also is through the ACE, the adverse childhood experiences, and that maybe that's connected. It's hard to know how much or little, but it sounds like there's a framework around adverse childhood experiences, and maybe that is related to a lot of that goes through. So I think in a way, sometimes we wonder what is Nutcracker versus this versus that, and in a way, there's a lot of overlap or related
There
pieces too.
is. I have not met a nutcracker person that when you start getting into a conversation that they don't score high on the ACE. You know, I have yet to meet somebody and I'm like, interesting,
I've got a high
interesting.
score.
Yeah, I'm like, what's your score on the ACE? It's probably not below this. Because I really it's so interconnected. You know, the comorbidities like, you know, MCAS, EDS, lupus, what are the POTS? I have that.
Gastroparesis.
It's yeah, gastroparesis, like all of the it's so crazy how I mean, but the vascular system goes through the entire body, so of course it would do that. I am, let's see what some other questions on here. I want to make sure. I feel like we've kind of hit on a lot of them as we've gone along. What are you all most proud of, maybe individually as a couple, looking back on the last 3 years? I know you're still in the middle of it, but what are y'all most proud of from all of this?
I mean, just super proud of her being able to be as both getting through it in a way, it's like driven, able to just deal with the worst pain and diagnoses ever, and yet still have such wonderful moments in there. Like I don't know, I could see myself even having like the times where you just give up hope, or it's hard to even have the next nice moment. And she still keeps coming back and doing so. And so yeah, having like most of your day feel awful, and then you get about, an hour where it feels okay to have that hour go okay, that's unbelievable.
Funny enough, I was going to say the same thing. But like, Danny is the calm, tranquil water that is so like soothing, and I am a raging firestorm. And I always have been, and I love that about me. And but I think me not giving up, even when I said I was going to, because the amount of times that I've come home to Danny just in tears because of an appointment I had with a doctor who dismissed me again and blamed it on my female anatomy. And it, you know, I'm really proud of now, you know, I'll still be sad and I'll still get those tears out because that's so important. And at the same time, it's all right. What do we do now? You know, or what is the next step when this doctor potentially, you know, doesn't listen to me? You know, getting those things in place so that if I do come crashing, it's already there. And Danny has been such a huge part of that. Like knowing if, you know, maybe I'm not crying, maybe I'm really pissed. And but he can tell, like, she needs a good cry. So like just to hug me and just be there and then help me make that AI model, make the, you know, like figure out you know, what questions to ask next or what doctors to look into. So our oh, he's just such a good caretaker.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, so I'm just really, really proud of not giving up and being there for each other because it is hard.
It is. And then it really boils down to like, at the end of the day, you have each other, and that's like such a beautiful thing to be in relationship and to have that connection, even when you're navigating something really hard, such as this. And what I'm also gathering from the both of you is that this has increased or expanded, if you will, your understanding of being able to rely on one another and like just the intimacy that that brings into a relationship as well of this different view that, right, like you think about relationships and it's all butterflies and roses and it's like, but the medical space brings this level of intimacy that like with Kyle and I, it's just like I unless you've been through it, you just don't really understand. And so I see that with you all, and I love that for you. I what there was one other question I want to talk. Like if you could go back on this journey and talk to yourselves on day one, what would you say? Like if you could go back to, and whatever that day one would be, maybe it could be the day of the diagnosis of Nutcracker, or maybe for you, Heather, it seems like it was prior to that. And tell, give yourself some wisdom, tell yourself what would that be? So for both of you.
Wow.
I think in a way it's like obvious. It's just about the uncertainty piece. It's like that there won't be answers. It's maybe the way that I grew up and lucky enough to have sort of minimal health issues myself, or just doctors that seem to have answers. It's just there won't. And to not think that there are and you're just missing it, or that they said it and we just didn't quite get it. It's that, there won't be. Sometimes there will be, but I think to even know that that's going to be how it is, I think comes to a little bit of it, hopefully acceptance a little bit earlier, and makes it okay a little bit more when you don't have those answers. Not to lessen even the continued search for more, but it's just it's going to happen.
Oh my gosh, I don't even know how to answer that, because it's so I think a problem that I had early on, because I am unfortunately used to finding my diagnosis before a doctor. It happened when I was
Yes.
18. I had a raging H. pylori infection in my stomach, and because I was a thin young woman, doctor for 6 months kept on saying I had an eating disorder. I'm like, no, I'm trying to eat. So
Yeah.
anyway, and then POTS, I found out about the diagnosis first and had to bring it to the right doctor. So when 3 years ago the lupus started, and then 5 years ago when that nutcracker pain started, I unfortunately was swinging too hard into the way of doctors are stupid, I'm going to figure it out. And that's
Yeah.
not true. There's kind of like this pride and these blinders that I had on of like, I'm not going to listen to anything doctors say, because I don't know what it is. And that's such a, it's so understandable, but it's such a dangerous place to put yourself, because
Yeah.
like doctors are doctors for a reason, and they have degrees for a reason, and they have specialties for a reason. Now, there are very rare things that are underdiagnosed and, there the whole time, but like you can't blame a doctor for not knowing every single possible condition in the whole wide world. And
Yeah.
so trying to find that balance sooner on in my journey of I do, like, I know my body better than anybody else. That is 100% certain.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I really need to be careful to not discredit what doctors say and to work with them. But at the same time, that also means finding a doctor who wants to work with me and not discredit everything I say. So it took a
Yeah.
while for me to find a good medical team. But oh, I love my medical team so much. My PCP, my
Same,
naturopath,
same.
yeah.
Oh, I
My
love all of them
chiropractor,
too.
yeah, like,
Yes.
oh, yeah, I make them all. I just made them all cookies for the holidays.
Yeah, I love that.
So,
Well,
yeah.
something I'm gathering from both of y'all is this kind of a if you could go back to day one and say, hey, almost like speaking to your ego a bit, because with Danny, you were talking about this concept of like you've had that privilege of creating their neural pathway of there will always be answers. And then almost going back to yourself and saying, hey, there is a world where answers aren't going to be present, like busting the ego, if you will, like popping that bubble of realizing that it's a one-to-one ratio. Because the moment that you could do that and try to like, and that's, you've talked about acceptance. I've heard a lot of mindfulness coming out of you of like really trying to stay in the present moment. And then for you too, Heather, this concept of ego, of you had gone one side of the pendulum of like, I know more than you. So let's bring that ego down and bring in like, actually, when you go into a space, and I actually like using the language of collaboration with my surgeons, with my team, especially I do have the privilege of vetting doctors because of the insurance plan I have through work. So I do go in and I say, hey, I want to collaborate with you on this. Like, I want this to be a team effort. And so putting that something for you going back, it's like you would tell yourself on day one, like, hey, Let's actually put more of a collaboration cap on, go in, try to collaborate. And then I think that's so beautifully accompanied by where not everybody's privileged to have an answer, because something I think in the Nutcracker space for both the caretaker and ourselves that have been diagnosed is that we've weirdly found our bodies in the crosshairs, for lack of a better word, on the cutting edge of medicine, where medicine doesn't even really know about us, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, how did I find myself here? Like, I didn't mean to get like ahead of medicine, you know? I
Yeah.
kind of wanted to find my body in the middle of it. I wanted to find my body in the middle of the textbook right there, and then there's the answer in
Yeah.
paragraph two. Like, why did I find myself in like I'm outside the textbook because I don't even know about it.
Yeah.
So I think these are really beautiful things you're saying as a reminder to the audience of like, hey, let's remember to put your collaboration hat on and remember that you could walk into a doctor's appointment and not get the answers. And then how can we mitigate the frustration that comes from that? And then you, Heather, kind of brought that solution in. I was like you, I'm a very solution. I had like three or four I already had my second and third opinion already scheduled, because I was like, okay, if this first one comes in and tries to be a little, you know, come in with an attitude and not like they know, you know what? Don't worry about it. I'm going to see somebody next week. Like, I went ahead and proactively was like, I'm planning on you all to screw me over. I'm gonna find somebody. No, thank you all for sharing that. I think that's some great wisdom. What is some of y'all's advice? So Danny, I'm curious to hear from you. If you're on the mic talking to another caretaker, what is your advice to other caretakers that are possibly listening?
I'll just start with the simple one, just be there for them. That's physically just being next to them. Ways. There may be more to it than that too, but I think everything starts there. It's just, and even if you can't be there with them physically, it's okay. And that's an important piece too, is that there's time to be apart. I don't know. My heart goes out to people who don't have a partner there with them. I just feel like that's so helpful for us, just to be in our house together, or be I can help her when she's not feeling well. Other quick advice, maybe this is a time to talk about the AI piece, because I also want to be careful with that too. So I feel very strongly that it can be a positive thing and also a negative thing. So I would advise caretakers and anybody to look into using AI to help them with their just either their diagnosis. You want to be careful because it won't diagnose you officially, and it's something that it may get wrong. But there are ways to use these tools that are really helpful. So if someone's very, very skeptical and hasn't tried it yet, let me know. I'd be happy to help you figure out which ones to use or how to ask. It really matters that you provide good context. So you can't just say, "Hey, what's wrong with me?" You have to really give it some symptom journals or some lab results. But you also want to be careful about sensitive information if you're submitting your personal information to these things, and what they're doing and how they trained all these things, and who they're not giving credit to. And so there's a lot of real caution I have there too. But I just do feel like,
Absolutely.
going back to what you said, which is there's so much value in having somebody there for you. And when you don't have somebody there for you, you can have something that was there 24/7 to, both answer questions. And also, you also have to be careful with how it makes you feel, but also a little bit of validation. It's really sad to see this come from the machine versus when you want it to come from the doctor or the human. But it does, even maybe she can tell you about how it feels to have even the AI kind of validate what you're feeling, and maybe ways to even communicate with the people who haven't done you right, not to mention the help through the health aspects.
Absolutely. And if we get, you know, people reaching out about it, if you would be open to, you know, I might reach out and be like, hey, you want to do a separate episode to be able to elaborate more on this, obviously, because I think you're more recently, I got my leg ultrasounds back. It wasn't great. And I put it into AI and just said, can you actually create an image for me showing where the refluxes are? And it was awesome, because then I was able to be like, oh, it just helped me better digest what was going on with my legs and be like, oh, no wonder why my ankle is hurting worse than like my knee area. And so I do think there are like that those ethical ways to make you feel, again, reducing the uncertainty, gathering data is, so I think that's wonderful. And I'm glad you brought that back up, because there's ethical, unethical ways of using AI, how to navigate that. At times when Kyle wasn't really available or didn't have the space to want to chat, I would go to AI and kind of see like what were next questions. It'll sometimes help you create follow-up questions to ask the surgeon that you wouldn't have otherwise thought. So I think that's wonderful. What do you think, Danny, to further that, what do you wish people understood about the emotional labor of caring for somebody with Nutcracker or any other chronic illnesses, anything like that?
I think what is equally difficult and, deeply like life-changing in a hard way is equally powerful in a good way. And it's like the things that I'm learning, the care that I'm learning, the what it's like to be someone going through what she's going through is more important than most of the things I thought were important before. I think that's just one thing where, in a way, I was again privileged and lucky to not have to be going through this earlier in life. And so later in life, it comes with death. It comes with getting to know people in a different environment or people with health conditions, and all of those are just a reminder of what the reality of life is. And so, to me, in as difficult as it is, it's learning to navigate the real world and also finding a lot of like love and connection and the moments that you have together that really feel like it doesn't matter where you are, you're just together. So those, to me, I would really strongly recommend people know what you're in for as far as the hard stuff, but there's the good stuff too.
There is. It makes things sweeter. Like with Kyle and I now, it's like I look to some, I've been reading more into like the concept of awe and you go see a beautiful mountain landscape and it's just like you have no words for it, or Niagara Falls, like the seven wonders of the world, those type things. And like with this medical experience has almost gotten me to the point that like I see the like moments of awe with him more clearly now, because you the medical stuff does have a way of like ripping away the things that don't really matter. And I feel like for you too, Danny, something that's coming up for me is like having not being fixed on it having to be a certain way, but really like saying, okay, like this is going to be hard, and yet let's grow through this. Let's like see what there's beauty in this too, and let's not try to like put the blinders on to not see it because we're being stubborn. Let's actually open ourselves up to seeing, like with Kyle, it's I remember there was one night I was just sobbing and I was like, thank you so much. I would be dead without you, right? Like it was a serendipitous bumble match that if I didn't match with you, if it was the 20 seconds that literally changed my life, and it was just those type things, I think are very important into the in this space of, coming into it and realizing it's not fun, but it's also going to be a journey just like anything else will. Heather, I'm curious for you, what is some advice that you would give another nutcracker, another chronic illness person navigating the space with a partner?
So a couple things. So first, let them do it. I had a lot of guilt. And I'm still kind of working through it of feeling guilty for putting him in the situation, like I have any control over it. And my counselor has told me that she's been like, Heather, he is with you and he choose like, are you making him stay? No. Like he has chosen to be with you. So let him do it. So I'm still kind of, trying to process that, but let them do it. Another thing is let them know what the pain feels like. I feel like a lot of people I have known that have Nutcracker or other compressions, it's not the only thing they have. There's other things going on, and so like chronic pain and chronic illness, but especially chronic pain, like I don't wince when a doctor presses on my abdomen. I have to be like, oh yeah, ow, like so they know it. Because I'm just like, they're expecting the average person to wince, but I'm like, I'm so used to it. So I feel like with chronic pain, you just get so used to it, and it won't necessarily make sense to your caretaker. So I try to explain a pain to him so that he kind of like gets it. And the point of that is I don't, and my last piece of advice too that goes along with this is try to keep their cup full as much as possible. Like don't like let them know what the pain feels like, what your symptoms feel like, so that they can have a better idea of what you're going through and could better like potentially help you or at least just kind of understand. And at the same time, like try to help them as much as you can with their autonomy, with their like asking, is it okay if I talk to you about something health related? Letting them, without, judgment or anything, take their time so that I can lay in bed and watch a show I've watched 50 times. let them like try to help them keep themselves, because it's like that analogy, or not analogy, you have to do it on an airplane. If the masks come down and you're a parent, you have to put it on you first, or else you could die before you put it on your kid. So it's kind of that same thing of like they can only help you if they are whole. Whole enough. So trying to like let them know what you're going through, but at the same time understand that they need some time by themselves and to feel to not feel what you're going through, so that they can stay whole and they can still be themselves as well. It's a tricky balance.
Absolutely. It is. And I think it really just starts with having a conversation. And what I'm hoping these episodes will start sparking couples and caretaker groups to have the conversation with each other, of just like, ooh, this, I heard this on this podcast today and it made me think we should maybe like write these things down. I never thought about this. But my first 2 degrees are in communication and specifically on interpersonal communication. And then my PhD is in sports psychology. But it's very much like the biggest thing you start to realize is the lack of communication that's happening in this world. And there's almost like I don't know the research on this, but I almost feel like there's like a direct positive correlation of like the more technology comes into our world, the less kind of direct conversations we're having with people. And so this podcast is what I'm really hoping to help caretakers, help couples, help parent, child to better be able to support both parties, because it's a very isolating experience for caretakers. It's isolating for the person diagnosed, but it's isolating in a different way for a caretaker. There's, like Kyle would say all the time, nobody when we go to the ER is asking me how I'm doing, and of course, rightfully so, because it's like I'm the one in there with the emergent issue, but at none of the doctor's appointments has a doctor looked at him and been like, how are you doing with all of this? And it's not like he's looking for them to ask that, but you're just kind of like you're a lamp on a side table in a sense, through it in the eyes of the medical space. And I'm like, I hate that. That's which is why I want to do this. I am curious as we close out, are there other things that we haven't touched on that maybe when y'all were looking through these questions prior that you were like, oh, I actually haven't said this and I really want to make sure it gets captured on this episode.
Well, maybe just one comment is to everybody who is out there in the situation. I really feel for you, and I feel like both in the caretaker and the patient situation. So I just really wanted to say thank you for putting this podcast together. And like you just said, just sharing these, I think none of these things are going to get out there unless we hear them. And so just having voices in this community and you leading this, I really appreciate that. So thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you all. I get so much energy out of these episodes and being able to help provide a platform to capture stories for other people to listen. And I just think my hope is that it does elevate and make people feel like there's this kind of trauma bonding community that we all have of like, so thank you all for being willing to be on this, to record your episode, to be vulnerable. At this point, moving forward, we're all a part of the same community and we're for lack of a better word, family of sorts. That can be a convoluted word for some, but that's what I'm here for. And so if I can ever help in any way, if you come up with either any like how I was talking about with episode ideas, but if you're like, ooh, this would be a good episode, let me know. I would love to capture it on the
Great.
show. But Thank you for saying that. That feels wonderful. It feels, and again, thank you. So just a lot of gratitude, bidirectionally for us. So thank you all for sharing. Thank you for being here and taking the time. Heather, even for you, kind of amidst your pain that you're having today. I know that feeling. My legs are currently swelling, so I'm, kind of having to bring my, like, nope, be in the present, be in the present. But wonderful. Well, thank you again for being here,
Thank you.
and sharing your story. And for all of you that are listening, I invite you to continue listening to the other lived experience of caretakers' roles and the bidirectional relationship between caretakers and the patient. And hopefully this is inspiring to you to take with you into having explicit conversations with those that you are interacting with so that all parties can be as supported as possible. So thank you all for listening.
Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you.